All right, are we all good? Okay, welcome everybody. This is the resumed hearing, and this morning we're hearing Drs. Fox and Whittle and their submission, and also zoomed in is Ms. Tancock to answer questions because she delivered her submissions towards the end of the day and we all needed to take time to reflect on that. I propose to kick off the questions, if I may, and unless you would prefer, Ms. Tancock, to have your clients present their evidence first and then answer questions all at the end. Is that a preference of yours? I know that you did make a point about resources, and my method was simply to ask you the questions and then you can decide whether you want to leave or not. That was how I thought we might go, but I'm subject to what you think.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and the Commissioners. Look, I'm happy to answer questions now and then leave you to it with the submissions. I'll be listening in, but I'd prefer to keep going.
Thank you. So I was particularly interested in your submissions at paragraph 57 onwards, which address the chicken and egg situation that is often the case with designations that are both not only authorising work but potentially strategically holding land for its strategic value. And you've quoted the Basin Bridge proposal and some extracts from the decision of the Board of Inquiry. And you indicated at paragraph 58 that the High Court on Appeal had confirmed that approach. Was that a explicit part of Justice Brown's decision in that case?
I'm very sorry, Sarah. Actually, that was one thing that I forgot that I needed to check for you. So I might do that and let you know the answer after Dr. Fox.
Yes. My recollection of that decision was it was more focused on the issue of whether historic heritage could be brought in under Part 2 in the absence of strong protective provisions in the district plan because it was an unanticipated project. That was my recollection, but
I will confirm that. If it helps, I don't think this is actually also, this case is also cited in Ms. Arthur Young's submissions on the same point. So I don't think there's any disagreement that we need to assess in terms of the case law of the project as is, where is. My subsequent submission from that was that if you look at the way that the economic evidence had been assessed, it was very unclear whether the integrated projects had been factored in when they were considering what the benefits were of a fully operational freight hub. So I don't think there's any... I will confirm the point on appeal, but I don't think that there's any disagreement between Council for KiwiRail and myself as to the fact that the legal proposition is it is as is where is in relation to those other projects.
Well, I just want to tease that out and to see whether this is analogically similar or not in terms of how that issue was addressed. So my understanding with the Basin Bridge project was that Waka Kotahi were contending that the benefits of the bridge proposal should be considered in light of their cumulative contribution to transportation efficiencies that would derive from projects that were not before the panel.
Yes. So the other components of the Basin Bridge project were going to link up to. So there was some reference to those projects, but they hadn't been, they would be subject to future designation processes, but they hadn't been advanced at that point.
Yes. In this case, there's no dependency in an absolute sense on the ring road, except that it will have adverse effects on the transportation network if the ring road isn't constructed. So it's not a case where there is a contention that the benefits are contingent on other projects. It's more that the adverse effects would be significantly greater than estimated if the upgrade does not occur. Is that right?
That, sir, wasn't my understanding from reading Ms. Fraser's evidence, who is obviously the council's traffic expert. I think she raised the issue of whether the project could become fully integrated in terms of efficiency and the claimed benefits of efficiency of the project without the those future upgrades.
Yes.
And it may, I haven't looked at all the details, so I don't think we're dealing with adverse effects here. I think we're dealing with the claimed efficiency and the claimed positive effects of economic efficiency that the Freight Hub hopes to achieve.
Right. So to the extent that beyond the benefits of the proposal, any other additional efficiencies might accrue from the ring road, they are more speculative and therefore have to be somewhat treated more cautiously. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and from the you'll see in Ms. Fraser's evidence, and it may be something that she's better to explain when she appears before the panel later, when you continue with that. But you'll see she's saying connectivity is key to the success of the freight hub.
Mm.
It includes connectivity by road and rail, and to be able to unlock those and have the efficiencies that were required. My understanding was that there is a certain, there's certain upgrades that are going to be required in the wider traffic network system, and those are projects which we've all accepted can't be considered right now.
Mm.
In turn, so she raises in her evidence, and I think this is followed through with Mr. Percy and the other planners in the council's report, that the objective, one of the objectives of the proposal is around connectivity and efficiency, and they question whether that can be properly assessed based on the fact that it's reliant on these projects that haven't happened to enable that to occur. My point at 61 and 60 is a little bit narrower than that. It's just it really is if the panel's looking at what the positive effects of the freight hub are, and KiwiRail has filed quite substantial evidence in terms of the economic and positive benefits that are going to flow as a result of the freight hub. I'm just saying if that's been assessed in reliance of the assumption that it's going to be fully integrated in the traffic network, because that's not the way that the project's being advanced. My understanding is they're saying you need to assess the project as is, whereas that we can do this without doing those. But my question is, when you're talking about fully operational effects, is it dependent on that? And if you go to 65, paragraph 65, of my submissions, you'll see there seemed to me to be a little bit of an inconsistency in KiwiRail's approach. And Ms. Bell says the delivery of the Palmerston North NIPD program works will be important to enable the benefits of the freight hub to be fully realised and become fully operational.
Mm.
So that's my point, sir. If to be able to unlock the benefits, the project is reliant on all those other projects which we don't know will go ahead.
Mm.
In order to become fully operational and fully integrated and connected, and of course, remembering no one's going to use the freight hub if the traffic delays, etc., are so bad that it's inefficient.
Mm.
Then my question is, and I've read through the briefs of evidence very, very carefully, and I just couldn't see any reference to the as is, where is scenario being reflected in what Mr. Paling and Mr. Colgrove were saying in relation to the fully operational benefits or even the partially operational benefits.
If I refer you to paragraph 7 of the application.
Ooh. That might be a little bit tricky, but if you're able to read that out to me, that would be fantastic.
So it says, KiwiRail's objectives in developing a rail freight hub in or near Palmerston North on the North Island Main Trunk Line are to increase its operational capacity to officially accommodate projected regional and national freight growth and support wider regional development, enable rail to be integrated with and connected to other transport modes and networks, and improve the resilience of the regional and national freight transport system over time. And so the way I read those objectives, there's an element of strategic location, strategic planning intrinsic in the designation, in the sense that you've got major infrastructure and there is an eye to the wider planning, strategic transportation planning that's occurring. And my question is, if you look at section 171 of the Resource Management Act, which sets out the matters we must consider, it says that we must consider the effects on the environment of allowing the requirement, having particular regard to, and then it lists the matters, and then it says whether the work and designation are reasonably necessary for achieving the objectives of the requiring authority for which the designation is sought. In other words, one of the lenses by which you evaluate those effects is against the objectives. And if those objectives are expressed in a strategic form, don't we have to have an eye to the strategic transportation planning of the region to see how this all works, and not just an as-is, where-is position? Because if that were so, one of the fundamental drivers of designation, which is, and seems to me, strategic location of infrastructure, gets somewhat undermined. In other words, it goes against the scheme of having a designation process and formulating strategic objectives.
I think to an extent, yes, I think that there is the ability to have strategic objectives. I think that's a fair point, and that might be something that you want to take up with the council's planners and Ms. Fraser, who's also raised that concern. I don't think, I still don't think, if you're considering the strategic, whether the strategic objective is achieved, whether if we go back to the as is, where is, and the case law around that, whether you can count positive effects that, you know, are reliant on future projects. I think there's a bit of tension there. The two might be slightly inconsistent.
And the other difficulty I have is, if it is strategic, isn't it also relevant what the consequence would be if you didn't plan for this type of infrastructure in the face of projected regional growth? In other words, a counterfactual is that there is no planning, and how that would affect the integration between modalities. I know that becomes somewhat speculative, but if you only have an eye to what the effects of the activity are without considering the effects of not allowing the activity, you get a somewhat skewed analysis that isn't real. Do you agree with that?
I am struggling a little with that, sir, and it might be just because I've got my effects hat still on. But, you know, the Basin Bridge case is quite a good example. And in that case, they had components, you know, designations and other projects that were going to integrate into that that were far more developed from a strategic perspective. And still the Board of Inquiry found that they shouldn't be considering those subsequent effects or positive benefits that incurred, you know, as a result of those projects. So, yes, there may be some, obviously KiwiRail can set its own objectives and strategic connectivity might be one of those. But I'm still uncomfortable with the proposition that that means that you can claim or consider positive effects of aspects of the project, which are clearly, you know, quite speculative and dependent on other things happening. I think the two are quite difficult to reconcile, but that's the concern, and that's the sort of case law approach to effects.
Well, it is one. The reason I'm asking you these questions is because I'm struggling with the analysis of the Board of Inquiry, and I'm not convinced it's completely accurately right, because I think one consequence of not strategically planning is not advancing a transportation solution, which is potentially have adverse effects on the environment. In other words, if the journey is one of a number of steps, how does not taking one step adversely affect the journey? And it seems to me very impractical to take such a blinkered approach to say we don't see this in the wider strategic planning context. And if that's what the Basin Board of Inquiry did, then I would have to be persuaded that that was actually correct in light of Section 171.
I mean, wouldn't that sort of approach bring into sort of start to compromise on some of the case law around with Hawthorne and future environments and things like that?
Not necessarily. I think Hawthorne was about what additional or other or further effect is there beyond that which could occur in the environment as of right or by reason of unimplemented consents. I'm not suggesting that we are looking at an existing environment analysis. What I'm suggesting is that the way in which Section 171 is constructed, it appears to be requiring us to consider all effects on the environment through the lens of strategy, consideration of alternatives, and whether the objectives are necessary. So there's a very much strategic flavour to the lens, and I'm not sure how that scheme can be fully respected by simply not looking at the wider strategic context in which this exists.
I mean, it may be another, you know, you do have the ability to look at other matters under 171, and that may be something that the panel wants to look at in terms of the strategic and obviously the transport documents and the rail strategy, which I think the council and KiwiRail have suggested a relevant consideration. So that is obviously going to need to be something that the panel look at through that lens. I'd just say that we've all seen those documents come and go, and there'd be particularly with large roading projects, they've been proposed and then they've, you know, been taken off the table and they're less popular, or they haven't been advanced in the timeframes, or all of those things. And here the applicant's been very clear of the need to have that wider network resolved so that the freight hub can achieve those full operational benefits. So, I don't think it's an easy task that the panel have, but I think if you do need to look at whether those positive effects that are claimed are realistic, whether they're fanciful, whether they should be to the extent that they're reliant on those other infrastructure projects to occur.
Yeah, I do understand that point. I guess if we accept that Palmerston North is a good location for a distribution hub and freight will be a part of that, and it needs to be strategically planned for, wouldn't it be logical in selecting the site to have an eye to the wider strategic planning that's occurring in terms of the other transport modalities?
Look, potentially yes, to the extent it's provided for in those documents. It's just when it gets to how you consider, whether you consider the effects and the weight that you place on those documents, I think that's something that the panel's going to have to look at pretty carefully.
Right. And do I take it that the business case for the ring road is approved by the board? In other words, the board of Waka Kotahi take the view that on the present situation, it meets their cost benefit, and that if this project is approved, that's only likely to reinforce that business case rather than undermine it. Is that?
I'm afraid I'm not across the detail of where that's at. Obviously, again, in Basin Bridge, they said it may be quite far advanced, but if it's not, hasn't been applied for and there's no designation in place, then they didn't feel they should be relying on linking up those projects. I'm not aware of the specifics of the
project. I'll need to read how they, in what context they specifically did it. It might be limited to assessing transportation efficiencies as opposed to a wider strategic planning lens.
I found the
proposition interesting and I wanted to test it, so I'm grateful for the opportunity to explore it with you.
One last thought that I did have while we were talking about this, Sir, is that the KiwiRail has excluded the adverse effects of those projects. So they're saying the adverse effects aren't relevant because it's as is, where is. You don't need to think about these things. But they're claiming the positive effects. So in my submission, if you did find that they were strategically, there was some basis for you to, the panel to strategically rely upon aspects of those future proposed projects, whenever they might occur, I would ask that the panel's consistent in its treatment of effects. And I think that would only be fair for those people. And I think if you take that approach, then it becomes very difficult, because if you're looking at what the proposed adverse effects might be, of course you don't have the details of those future projects. And KiwiRail's been quite clear about, you know, you don't need to worry about the ring road. We'll address it later if it happens. We don't need to address those adverse effects. So I think there needs to be some level playing field in terms of how the panel treats those projects. And it's not just the potential positive effects of them that are reflected in the freight hub becoming fully operational and reaping the benefits of connectivity. If you are going to consider that the positive effects should be taken into account, then I would suggest that the adverse effects are also relevant, and I think that's where you get into some difficulties.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll muddle our way through that in due course.
Good luck.
Now, the next question I had was about the comment about outline plans at paragraph 72 of your submission. And I don't know whether you have picked up that the applicant is initially on the journey, the applicant did postulate that the heavy lifting would be done in the outline plans, but has moved more to a stricter approach in the proposed conditions, which is in general accordance with a defined concept plan and information supplied and further information supplied in the application, so that the management plans are now performing the function of essentially implementing that body of information and its intent. Have you observed that shift in position? I think part of that response has come through the council performing its regulatory function and essentially pushing back on the outline plan doing the heavy lifting, and that's nudged the applicant to a different framework. Have you got any comment to make about that?
Well, I find that very interesting, sir, because you're right, I hadn't actually picked up on that. Just in terms of that, is it proposed that Kiwi Rail are now advancing the concept development plan sort of as an outline development plan, or is there still intended that there will be an outline development plan?
The outline plans will have to conform with the concept plan, which has a much higher level of detail. So the concern was that the concept plan could become nothing more than just one configuration of many, and we'll know what the configuration is at the outline plan. But, of course, all the assessment of effects has been done on the basis of the concept plan. So that seemed to be unattractive. So I'm not saying there won't be outline plans as contemplated by Kiwi Rail's application, but it seems to me that the opportunity for the outline plans to depart in any material way from the concept plan are now significantly diminished by the way in which the conditions are framed.
Yes, and I agree. I think that is a benefit. It does provide some certainty in terms of what is proposed. One comment that I would have is that I still don't feel that the information that's being provided to support that and ongoing throughout the process is at a level where you may fully have the effects of those concept plans, because all of Kiwi Rail's application and evidence was written on the basis, and I've been more familiar than what's been going on in the hearing, was written on the basis of the fact that they would, this might be one concept plan and they might do something else and they don't quite know what these effects might be. So they've still taken a very broad envelope approach to that, although, there is some benefit to vaguely knowing where some of that infrastructure actually will sit.
So that then leads to paragraph 75 of your submissions. And the idea of an absence of hard limits. And as I understand it, for example, there will be hard limits on vibration, there will be hard limits on dust, there will be hard limits on noise. What they are yet is a matter of debate between the experts. This is what I'm saying in terms of the people who are proposing. They are proposing to us hard limits. I think the respective acousticians are at the point of debating whether the level should be measured at the notional boundary or the physical boundary, but they are limits. So my question is, in light of the amended conditions, to what extent are there not hard limits proposed by the applicant?
Okay, so I did have a brief look at the conditions. I must say I was sent through, Mr. Jessen kindly sent some through to me, and I wasn't sure whether they were the council's or KiwiRail's proposed conditions at that point, because the previous version had the council version and KiwiRail's on it. So he confirmed to me last night. My clients were a little uncomfortable in terms of resources of having me review or attempt to review a full suite of these revised conditions, and obviously there's been some time constraints. That said, I thought you might be interested in that, so I did have a quick look at, and I'll just say two examples. I don't know whether this is going to be, it may be wider, but I was conscious of Commissioner Sweetman's question to me earlier in the week. So I've looked at the conditions proposed by KiwiRail, and I would respectfully disagree that there are hard limits imposed. And the reason that I say that is because with construction noise and also with operational noise, there's a get-out-of-jail-free card in terms of how these things are applied. And you'll find, and I address these concerns in relation to the earlier version of the conditions, but in my mind, these just simply haven't been addressed yet. Might pay to take you to those conditions, the 13 August ones, and we can discuss it with those in front of us, if that's okay.
Yeah, so are you looking at conditions 68 and following?
I was actually first going to take you to condition 71, which is the construction noise limit.
Right.
So it says all works may be undertaken to ensure as, and it's obviously got the as far as practicable, so not quite a hard limit. And they don't exceed the limits in Table 1. They must be measured in accordance with the acoustic standard for construction noise, and that's just at occupied dwellings. So there's a little bit of a difference there in terms of what the standard provides. The limits in the table, I haven't had a chance to check, but I'm assuming they're the same as the construction noise standard. But then we've got this construction work. So there's still the provision for construction work at night time, which I think was something that Dr. Giles previously said that they wouldn't necessarily be doing. The nighttime construction, 71A, the nighttime construction work that exceeds the noise limits in the table in condition 1 and table 2 for vibration shall only take place if works cannot practically be undertaken during daytime hours. So 71A, Sarah, in my submission, that is pretty clear indication that the construction noise limits can be breached. So to me, that doesn't appear to be a hard limit. Mm. So there's been a suggestion, but it's still leaving it open there. If we go over the page we look at the vibration condition. So you've got table 2 and you've got those set out there. And then you've got C at the top of page 13, which says the category A construction vibration table must be complied with as far as practicable. So again, it's not a has to be complied with at all costs. It's, you know, if you can manage it. Mm. And then it provides if the measured or predicted vibration from the works exceed category A criteria, what do you get? You get an independent, suitably qualified, experienced person assessing and managing vibration. So again, you're not set at the limit. There's a process if you exceed it, and in my submission it almost sets it up as an exception, given some of the earlier evidence of Dr. Charles, that they just simply won't be able to meet some of these. So you've got an experienced person assessing and managing construction vibration during those activities. The next, there's no more detail as to what that means. And we have a little bit more detail in D. If measured or predicted vibration from the works exceed the category B criteria, those activities must only proceed if vibration effects on buildings are assessed and monitored. And the vibration effects shall be mitigated in accordance with that person's recommendation. And so I guess my question still remains, what happens if you're a homeowner in that category of D and you're experiencing vibration effects that are over and above the limits provided in 2? Kiwi Rail are saying it's reasonably practicable. You've got an independent person monitoring it, but what happens if the mitigation isn't sufficient? There's no, you must not exceed X in this situation, and there's nothing to give any of the residents any comfort as to what they might expect at a property if they are having those ongoing issues with construction noise and vibration.
Right.
So that's one example. If we follow that theme through from condition 73 in concept 73, which is the construction management plan, and that achieves the conditions, so that must show how it's being managed. And you get down to K, again, if where the construction noise limits in table 1, condition 71 will be exceeded, or whether they'll be exceeded, and the mitigation to be put in place. But it doesn't provide an expectation as to what that mitigation must achieve. And again, there's mitigation in L, you've got mitigation to minimise the noise effects of any nighttime construction work that exceeds the noise limits in table 1, 71 in table 2. So, I mean, normally the panel should or submitter should be able to have some confidence that application of those New Zealand standards are going to provide them with an adequate level of protection. And certainly that's what the case law says. But in my submission, there's a lot of exceptions to how these standards have been applied. And so it's a soft limit, it's not a hard limit. And the council and everyone will have learned from these experiences with wind farms that if you don't have these hard limits, you get into a situation where you have parties who are at houses where there is mitigation going on, such as, air conditioning, ventilation, windows, etc.
Yeah.
And then what do you do? and I think that's the question. So, again, you can do the same exercise with the operational noise limits if you're interested in that as well.
No, I think I've got the flavour of that, and I think that's important for us to look at.
Just in relation to the operational noise, just one point, I won't go further than that. But again, you'll see the operational noise and vibration in that condition excludes the perimeter road traffic and rail traffic. So operational noise at this point, in the conditions that I've seen, doesn't appear to have a definition, so we don't actually know what those activities comprise of. But also operational noise of the freight hub is excluding those two key noise, in my submission, two key noise sources. And in the conferencing statement, both Dr. Charles and Mr. Lloyd are very clear that if those other activities are considered, then the noise level is going to be higher. So I think in my submission a lot more work to be done, and particularly with the operational noise limits, that there's, you know, a similar get out of free card, and they're not hard limits, and it would be good for everyone involved if there were hard limits, so that there was an expectation as to what could happen if they were breached.
No, that's very helpful, thank you. So just closing off for me, you were going to get me the reference in the architectural, is it, the Basin Bridge High Court decision?
Yes, I'll just check the scope of that too, sir.
And you said that there was some reference in the submissions for the applicant around this point as well. I can't see anything directly related to our conversation, but if there is, can you also give me that reference?
Yes. Are you happy to receive those via just an email?
Just by email would be fine. Okay. Thank you.
Great.
All right. So if you just remain there, I'll ask my other commissioners if they have any questions. Commissioner Sweetman.
Thank you. No further questions. The Chair has questioned you in the areas that I was going to, and thank you for taking the time to have a look at those conditions. The point you make in terms of the involvement of third parties in outline plan processes is a point well made, and it's certainly something which is front of mind to the panel. No further questions, and thank you very much for your submissions, and thanks to your clients for making your time available as well. It's appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Pamari?
Morena, Ms. Tancock. Thank you, and also to your clients as well for making yourself available this morning for further questioning from the panel. My questions have largely been answered, but there is still just one outstanding one that I would like to briefly explore with you. You do highlight in your legal submissions this general concern around the inadequacy of the assessment of effects undertaken by KiwiRail. And in relation to cultural effects, you note, as the panel has done throughout the hearing, that there has been a failure by KiwiRail to undertake any assessment at all in that regard. And you do go on to say that KiwiRail's recommended condition for the identification on the effects after the NOR has been confirmed cannot replace the need for the panel to understand what those effects are, and that it can't abdicate its responsibilities to decide what levels of adverse effects are appropriate. I'm just wondering, given that cultural issues will largely be dealt with at the detailed design stage during the regional consenting process, which will require close involvement with Mana Whenua, I'm wondering, and my question is, to what extent would you say that then truly represents, if you like, an abdication of responsibilities on our part to decide what levels of adverse cultural effects are appropriate?
That's a really good question. And, you know, obviously it's not an unusual situation for an infrastructure applicant, to be advancing a project without a CIA. And, you know, we all must be, you know, there's no obligation to provide one on anyone. And obviously there's no obligation on behalf of the Mana Whenua involved to actually provide those documents. So engagement by the applicant, or by KiwiRail in this case, isn't sort of a fatal blow. However, I think for the panel, often you'll find that the extent of that information vacuum that it creates is either filled or it's not filled as a result of Mana Whenua's submissions over the course of the hearing. And I'm afraid that I haven't been able to listen to everyone's submission, and so I don't know the extent that those parties have provided that information to the panel, the amount of information that you have as to the importance of the site, the area, what role that fills for Mana Whenua, the connection and those items that need to be addressed. What I am saying is that, you know, Section 6 provides for these at a national, you know, the panel must mandatorily give consideration as a matter of national importance to these, you know, Section 6E, Section 7A issues into Section 6H. And if you simply don't have any information about that, then, and you don't know what those effects are, then I don't understand how you can go on to allow someone to mitigate an effect that they don't know what the effect is. There may be an extent that the panel feels comfortable that that information has been provided through what submitters are saying in this hearing. Again, I don't know that, but I think that you should be very careful or cautious to ensure that, you know, I had seen some media coverage about the fact that there had been a treaty of Waitangi process, and that there was, that may concern some of this land, and I'm sorry, I don't know all the details, but I think it's those things that you need to satisfy yourself that you're comfortable with and that you've got a good grasp on what those effects might be. If you don't know them, you can't mitigate them, but I think also the panel owes a duty to Mana Whenua to ensure that those effects are properly considered. If you say go, yep, of course they can be addressed by these conditions later and it's just a process thing, then I think the panel needs to be very careful that it doesn't become a box-ticking exercise and that you're not delegating the concerns of those parties to effectively it's a fait accompli. And I realise that it's an information vacuum and attention that having heard the evidence you'll need to resolve. But I don't think saying, oh, well, we can look at this later. We don't know what it is, but, you know, maybe they could be involved in a planting plan or something is really going to cut the mustard here. And I appreciate it's a lot more complicated than that, but an example. So it can't be lip service. It needs to be, we know what these effects are and we're confident of the process going forward that they can be mitigated. And I'm not sure given there seems to be a very broad discrepancy as to what the consultation and engagement has occurred to date. And so I think there needs to be some confidence that would actually occur in a subsequent process, despite the fact that, you know, those parties would, it's sort of a fait accompli that the notice of requirements going ahead. So any other concerns they might have about the location or anything of that sort of been taken away. And I guess in light of the chair's comments that the concept design is now the actual design, whether you can reconcile what you've heard from those submitters to determine what those effects might be if they're locational.
I really appreciate your response, Ms. Tancock. That's really helpful. It doesn't make our job any easier, as you've already alluded to, but it has been most helpful. I really appreciate the comments. Thank you. Kia ora.
Thank you. Commissioner Mackinson.
Good morning, Ms. Tancock. I'd like to go back to the conversation you were having with Commissioner Marson around paragraphs 57 and 58 of your submission, and I don't intend to, you know, relitigate the whole lot. I think it was a very useful conversation and it did address a lot of the questions that I had. But whilst you're having that discussion, a couple of things came to mind, and I was just checking Mr. Jorgensen's evidence, who's providing traffic expertise on behalf of Kiwi Rail. And I noted in his evidence that when he was looking at the potential traffic effects of the Kiwi Rail Hub, and this will also speak to connectivity, the modelling that's been undertaken specifically excludes the Peenity project, so that freight ring road. There are a number of specific infrastructure works that are included within his modelling, And they're items that I understand are reasonably expected to come forward, given that they have funding in place in the long-term plan, etc. So I just wondered whether that lack of dependence on PNITI to consider the benefits and adverse traffic effects of the potential rail hub affects any of the conversation you had this morning with Commissioner Larson.
It's very good spotting, and I saw that. I did read Mr. Jordan's evidence and see the same thing. So Kiwi Rail are advancing that the project can occur without consideration of the project, and that they've assessed it on the traffic effects have been assessed on the basis that those effects aren't considered. In my submission, that's the correct approach. My point on it is whether, if you're excluding the traffic effects, whether you should probably also exclude the positive effects that go with the operational efficiency, transport efficiency, which is being, put on the positive effects of the ledger of the project at an economic perspective. So if you require the transport connectivity to be able to fully realise the freight hub, the positive benefits and fully operational freight hub, then whether you should be including those effects. Because
so essentially what you're saying, it comes down to if the economic assessment of benefits is based on Mr. Jordan's modelling, which excludes the PNITI project specifically, then there isn't a mismatch between positive and negative effects. But if it hasn't been done that way, then there is, and we're in a basin bridge situation.
I think so. And that's all I from my memory, that's all I was asking that the panel confirm, or get Kiwi Rail to confirm, how they've treated those effects and you know, that the positive economic effects of the project have been counted on an as-is basis, and with the caveat that I appreciate the Chair might have a different view on that. And also I'll just draw your attention to paragraph 65, which is Ms. Bell's acknowledgement that the delivery of the program will be important to enable the benefits to be fully realised and become fully operational. So it's that link that I'm interested in. But I appreciate Mr. Jorgensen has done, he's assessed the project and the traffic effects of it in what I would say would be the correct way.
Maybe the intent of that comment by Ms. Bell is something we should ask for clarification on. It could be as simple as it's semantics that we're dealing with here.
Absolutely, and of course the panel has the benefit of asking all these questions of the council and Kiwi Rail's experts, so maybe that's something you wish to pursue.
Thank you. I appreciate your time on that. That was my only question.
Yes, okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Tancock. That's been very helpful.
Thank you.
And you can see that your submissions have attracted the interest of commissioners, which is not always the case with legal submissions.
I don't envy you. Good luck with the rest of the process.
Thank you. Right, Dr. Fox.
I was going to ask, if it pleases the Chair, could I have a quick break, actually?
Yeah, actually, I want one too, so we'll just have a quick 5-minute break.